All right, it's Erev Tov, everybody. It's actually nice to be back. I've missed, I think, 5 weeks in a row on Thursday night. I've been different countries, and we're in Israel and traveling and whatever. So it's nice to be back. And Dr. Berger thanked me for coming back for his share. But okay, we'll let him give me those thanks, even though I probably don't earn them or deserve them. But just the way my schedule worked out. Anyways, a pleasure to welcome Professor Yitzchak Berger. Spoke on our Purim Yom Iyun, and then we invited him back, and he is professor of biblical studies at Hunter College, City University of New York, and a pleasure to have him. From Far Rockaway, New York. B'vakasha, Rav Yitzchak.
Okay, thank you. It's nice to be back, and I'm going to share a screen. I'll just say at the outset that there's a lot of Hebrew sources on the screen, but no one should be intimidated. I will be translating and just kind of reading selections and hopefully clarifying things as appropriate as we move along. So don't worry about what the screen looks like. I'm going to share the screen now. And we can begin. Now, you see the topic is questions of composition connecting to Sefer Devarim, medieval sources. And so many of you may be familiar with some of this kind of standard kinds of issues that arise in connection with Sefer Devarim. I'll emphasize that I'm going to try to spend the a majority of the time discussing something that's a little bit different, and that really concerns what we'll see on really the second and third pages of the handout. So we're going to begin by touching on some standard stuff, things that I'm not going to be adding very much to, as far as the standard observations that people tend to make. As quickly as we can, I'd like to turn our attention to another, I think, very interesting issue relating to Ibn Ezra. But it's, again, as if you're familiar with Ibn Ezra and Sefer Dvarim, it's not really the standard question pertaining to Ibn Ezra that I'm going to speak about. So if you're familiar with that issue, we'll just touch on it, but then we're going to be moving on to, I hope, something that'll be new for everyone. We kind of begin with the first topic or subtopic that you see on the screen, which is called Moshe Mipi Atzmo Amaran. There are a couple of sources in the Talmud that use this language of Moshe Mipi Atzmo Amaran. What does that mean in English? That Moshe said it himself. And this is language that we find most famously in connection with Sefer Dvarim, the Sefer that we're beginning this week. The first text, which I'll just highlight here, is a Talmudic passage from Megillah, where the discussion concerns a distinction between the what we call the Tochachot, right? Those sections of Sefer Vayikra and Sefer Dvarim, which contain a great deal of admonishment and warning as to all kinds of terrible things that will happen to Bnei Yisrael if they do not follow God's will. The Talmud here draws a distinction between the passage in Vayikra and the passage in Dvarim, telling us that the passage in Dvarim has certain leniency with respect to reading it in shul, that you're allowed to, in principle, break up the reading of the Tochachot and Sefer Dvarim into two, so that you could call somebody up in the middle. And there are a couple of reasons given as to why it's a more lenient thing. But the one that's of interest to us is this line, that whereas the ones in Vayikra, Moshe Mipi HaGevurah Amaran, Moshe said them in the name of God, the ones in Devarim, Moshe Mipi Atzmo Amaran, that Moshe said these tochachot, these admonishments, on his own. And then immediately raises the question, what do you mean Moshe said these on his own? Because the standard traditional position is, of course, that everything in the Torah was dictated to Moshe by God. And in fact, you find precisely this language in what is really the most powerful statement in rabbinic sources about the authorship of the Torah. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, which is the next source, you know, says anybody who says that there's a part of the Torah that was not said by God, but rather, and here I'll highlight, Ela mi Moshe mi pi atzmo, if someone says Moshe said it on his own, and then it proceeds to say that it's sort of a disdainful thing to say toward the word of God. So here you have the Talmud saying nothing in the Torah can be Moshe mi pi atzmo, Moshe speaking on his own, and simultaneously we have the Talmudic passage in Megillah, which tells us that these admonishments in Sefer Dvarim is Moshe Mipi Atzmo Amar. Moshe actually said these on his own. So this immediately requires explanations, you know, a very standard problem that is raised. And there is a fairly straightforward answer, which is really probably the answer that is assumed by the majority of traditional commentators, even if they don't say it explicitly. And that's as follows, right? Really, Sefer Dvarim generally, and that's presumably what the Talmud means when it makes that statement, Sefer Dvarim generally is Moshe speaking, right? It is a valedictory address that Moshe gives Bnei Yisrael before they are to enter Eretz Yisrael, and before Moshe's death, which is going to precede that entry into Eretz Yisrael. So right here we have the beginning of Sefer Dvarim in this paragraph, which I'm not going to read at length here. But the first few psukim of Sefer Dvarim tell you, you know, these are the words that Moshe spoke. And in this very last pasuk, it says that in this location, Ho'il Moshe be'eret haTorah hazot. And this language of Ho'il Moshe is one that the Ramban and the next source picks up on. And he says, what does it mean? When do we use a language of ho'il? What does it mean? And the answer he gives, betam ho'il Moshe is sheratza leva'er bahem ha'Torah. Right? Moshe desired to explain the Torah to Bnei Yisrael, and so he presented this address to them before his death, preceding their entry into Eretz Yisrael. Ho'il means he kind of wanted to do it on his own. The Ramban proceeds to say, "V'hizkir kein lahudia ki me'atzmo ra'ala asot kein." Moshe decided to do this on his own. V'lo tzivahu Hashem bazeh. Moshe did not, did not command Moshe to do this. So this is Moshe's own initiative, to give this address to Bnei Yisrael. If in fact it's Moshe's own address, so then we still have our question. Right? What does it mean then that Moshe said this if, right, we're so accustomed to thinking based on, the other statement in the Talmud that, you know, one can never say that Moshe said any part of the Torah on his own? What does it mean? You know, when the Ramban says, you know, Moshe me'atzmo ra'ala asot kein, that he decided to do it on his own, does he mean to imply some kind of controversial position? And the answer to this question is certainly not. You have here in the Ramban, again, don't be scared by the long paragraph. We're only going to isolate a couple of sentences from it. But in this introduction of the Ramban to his commentary on the Torah, right, or the introduction to Sefer Bereishit, the beginning of the Torah, the Ramban speaks about, you know, certain issues of how the Torah presents its material. And to summarize what he says here in the beginning of the paragraph, this is, why doesn't it say that God told Moshe all the following things at the very beginning of Sefer Bereishit? Right? Shouldn't it have said that? Well, I mean, the answer the Ramban says is that it's assumed, you're supposed to know, that the Torah is divine, and that Moshe is kind of writing this, even writing about himself in third person. And then when you get to Sefer Devarim, it's different because Moshe is speaking in first person. He's the one who's talking, so he's going to say things like Va'et Hanan, right? Next week's parsha begins Va'et Hanan. Right? I beseeched God that he should let me into Eretz Israel. So all of that is because the text tells you at the very beginning of Sefer Devarim that this is Moshe speaking. Right? So it's a very straightforward observation the Ramban makes. And then we'll take a look at the part that I bolded here, where he addresses the question of, okay, so, you know, how much of the Torah is really from God? And the Ramban says, Aval ze emet ubarur hu shekol ha-Torah kula, the entire Torah, right? Mitchilat Sefer Breishit, from the beginning, ad le'enei kol Yisrael, which is the last pasuk in the Torah, right? The entire Torah, mipiv shel ha-Kadosh Baruch Hu l'ozno shel Moshe. So the Ramban tells us explicitly, right, that the entire Torah is dictated by God to Moshe. Now, if that's the case, then we still have our question. So what did the Ramban mean back in the other passage where he told us that Sefer Dvarim is Moshe speaking on his own? I mean, even here he's acknowledging that Sefer Dvarim tells you that it's essentially a speech by Moshe. And again, as I said, the answer to this is really very straightforward, at least the presumed answer, which is articulated by some of the medieval parshanim, and again, is presumably just assumed by most of them without actually saying it. But it's maybe most famously articulated by the Abarbanel. The last two sources on the page are a couple of Abarbanels. The Abarbanel, in his introduction to Sefer Dvarim, raises these issues. He has sort of a bunch of questions. The Abarbanel always kind of lays out his questions, and he always has multiple questions, and there are questions that all surround the issue that we're raising here. How exactly are we supposed to understand the status of Sefer Dvarim over against the rest of the Torah, in light of the fact that Moshe seems to be speaking here, as the Talmud itself acknowledges. And the Abarbanel says that he presented this question to his Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Chayun. This is a worthwhile name to know. Rabbi Yosef Chayun is not someone who we're familiar with necessarily from our Jewish education, if we have one. But because most of his writings did not survive, at least initially, they weren't known. But the Rabbi Yosef Chayun was regarded to be sort of the Rebbe, the revered figure in that whole Beit Midrash that the Abarbanel was part of. It was really, really based in Portugal. The Abarbanel lived for most of his life in Spain and then came to Portugal after the expulsion briefly, before having to leave Portugal as well, as everyone else did. But the Abarbanel has an exchange with Chayun. And by the way, there is more and more material from Chayun being published. His material is often very much worth looking at. So Abarbanel has this exchange with Chayun, and we actually have Chayun's letter back to Abarbanel on these issues. So what is the upshot of it? In the final analysis, what does it mean that Moshe decided to say Sefer Dvarim, and it's Moshe mipi atzmo on his own? What does it mean if in fact the whole Torah is divine, as the Ramban said? The Ramban says it's divine on the one hand and it's Moshe on the other. So what does it mean? And the answer, and is, as I said, really quite straightforward. Let's kind of read the part that I bolded here. Ratza HaKadosh Baruch, God wanted, Acharei Shehishlim L'Omram LiYisrael, after Moshe completed his valedictory address, Sheikh Tov b'Sefer HaTorah kol zeh kefi ma she'amaro Moshe. God determined that this should be part of the Torah.
Right? Im kein, sh'amirat ha-dvarim ha-ela li-Yisrael ha-yumi Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who recited it. He said it. He made this speech. But lo ha-ita k'tivata b'sefer ha-Torah mimenu. Moshe is not the one who gets to decide what's in the Torah. Skip to the next bolded part, right, where he says it kind of very, very, very succinctly. Aval k'tivat ze kulo haya mipi ha-gvura k'chol divrei ha-Torah. The inclusion of this in the Torah was from God in keeping with all of the rest of the Torah. Ki hiskim ha-kadosh baruch hu al yado. God agreed with Moshe that this was a worthy speech to give, and in turn that he should write it. Okay, very simple explanation. The explanation is really so simple that it's one that we sort of assume when we read the Torah generally, because it's not just Sefer Dvarim that has this issue. There is much material in the Torah that is clearly said by people who are not Nevi'im, and certainly not Nevi'im on the level of Moshe, and those things are included in the Torah. Exchanges, right, give and take between Paro and his advisors, or between Paro and Yosef. Or, right, you can think of any one of a number of lines in the Torah, or even, you know, full passages in the Torah that are stated by people and are included in the Torah. Why? Because it was God's decision to include them in the Torah. Chayyun actually mentions this in connection with dialogue of the sort that I just indicated. There's another Abarbanel that's worth mentioning who stresses this point in connection with something that's kind of similar to Sefer Dvarim. It's a lengthy recitation that where the Torah tells you that this was recited by human beings. Right? What am I referring to? The Shirat Hayam. Right? It's the Shira, the song that Bnei Yisrael sang after Kriyat Yam Suf, when they crossed, when they got to cross Yam Suf on dry land. And it begins there, Az Yashir Moshe U Bnei Yisrael. At that point, Moshe and Bnei Yisrael recited or sang the following, and then you get a lengthy passage that's recited every day in the Siddur for Shacharit. So Abarbanel tells you in his Perush on Sefer Shmot, the Kach Haita Shirat Hayam. The same thing is true about Shirat Hayam. We won't read the whole thing. Just skip to the part that I've bolded here. Hine im kein sidur ha-shira hazot hayam Moshe Rabbeinu. B'ktivata b'Torah haita mipi ha-gvura. Right? Moshe led Bnei Yisrael in this song. He's the one who composed it. Bnei Yisrael sang along with him. And its inclusion in the Torah is by divine decision. Okay, so again, a very, very straightforward and seemingly very uncontroversial thing. And we will leave this particular kind of subtopic at that. Moving quickly to the next subtopic, as I'd like to kind of get as quickly as we can to what I regard to be the most important part of the presentation. There is, in connection with composition of the Torah and Sefer Dvarim, another very famous issue, and that concerns the last 8 psukim of the Torah, where Moshe Rabbeinu is said to have died. Right, it begins with the phrase "Vayamot Moshe," and Moshe died. Chazal wondered, right? So, like, how did that last part of the Torah get composed? Famous sort of classical passage about this is in the Talmud in Bava Batra. In Bava Batra, you have here a statement that it really comes from a source in Tanaim, that Yehoshua katav sifro, Yehoshua wrote his own book, which is Sefer Yehoshua, u'shmone psukim shabat Torah, that Yehoshua also wrote the last 8 psukim of the Torah, because how could Moshe Rabbeinu have written that Moshe died? Right? Doesn't seem to make sense. This is, in the Gemara continues to say that there is additional support in the in Tanaim and the early Talmudic sources for this. But there is also another opinion, and here we'll sort of skip to the alternative view. Amar lo Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon here is responding to the position that says that Yehoshua wrote the last eight psukim. And Rabbi Shimon says, how could that be? Efshar sefer Torah haser otachat. Is it possible that the Torah could be missing something? Right, when Moshe got through with it, it was still missing something, right? Uchtiv lakoach et sefer haTorah, as the Torah actually says that Moshe was told to take the sefer Torah. And so, right, Rabbi Shimon says it must be that Moshe actually wrote certain things prospectively. They hadn't happened yet. Most obviously, Moshe is dead, right? Right, and he proceeds to say, Ela ad kana kadosh baruch hu omer, right, up to the point when Moshe died, God would say, and Moshe omer v'kotev, right? Moshe would then record it. Mikan ve'elach, but from the time that it says, Vayamot Moshe, HaKadosh Baruch Hu omer, God said it to Moshe kotev b'dema. And that the simplest way to understand this, which is what we will invoke here, is that Moshe writes the last eight psukim of the Torah prospectively. It didn't happen yet, and he's writing it while in tears. There are other ways of understanding this, but we'll assume it means he writes it and he's emotional as he's writing. So that's Rabbi Shimon's insistence that the entire Torah had to have been recorded by Moshe. Now, again, there's much to say about this topic. And as I said, on this subtopic, we're only going to mention a couple of things. Really, the main thing I want to stress is something that that the Rambam writes in Hilchot Tefillah. Just to underscore something that may be familiar to some of you, but I suspect most are not familiar with it. The Talmud ends this passage, the part that I'm shading here, wants to know, there is a statement in the Amoraim, first generation Amora is Rav, right? A student of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi who put together the Mishnah. The statement in the name of Rav is Shmoneh Psukim Shabbat Torah Yachid Koreotan, which we'll assume means, and this is the way the Rambam is going to understand it, we'll assume means, even though it's controversial, but we'll assume it means that that you can read these last eight psukim in shul without a minyan. The Gemara wants to know, if you can read these last eight psukim in the Torah without a minyan, then, you know, whose position among the Tanaim is that consistent? The Gemara says, wait a second, you know, lema Rabbi Yehuda hi velo k'Rabbi Shimon. Maybe what we should say, look, this position that the last eight psukim in the Torah is more lenient really only follows the position of Rabbi Yehuda, who believes the last eight psukim were written by Yehoshua. Because if they weren't written by Moshe, perhaps they have a different status. It's a more lenient kind of thing. The Gemara answers no. Afilu tema Rabbi Shimon. You could also say that Rav is consistent with Rabbi Shimon, the one who believes that Moshe wrote the last eight psukim while crying. Now, if Moshe wrote them, and the whole point is that it has to be that Moshe wrote them, right? Moshe had to write the complete Torah. If that's the point, so why would they have a more lenient status? And so the answer is, well, ho'il v'ishtenu ishtenu. They have a more lenient status because they were written in a somewhat different way, right? Moshe didn't sort of repeat it after God. Moshe was not Omer. God says it, and Moshe just writes it hesitatingly while crying. So because of that change in the method by which it was, that subtle change, really, it's not much of a change, but because they are somewhat different in that respect, well, then it's changed, and that therefore they attain this more lenient status. Now, needless to say, you know, on the surface, it certainly seems like this halacha, that a yachid can read the last eight psukim again, which we're assuming means that they don't require a minyan, it certainly seems much more straightforward that it accords with Rabbi Yehuda's shita, right? Rabbi Yehuda's position that the last eight psukim were written by Yehoshua. And yet, right, the Gemara says, well, you can also come up with an explanation as to how it fits the position of Rabbi Shimon. Take a look at what the Rambam does here. Okay, the Rambam on this source, okay, he quotes the halacha, right, that you can, which as he understands it, means that you can read the last eight psukim of the Torah in shul without a minyan. And then the part that I've bolded here, the Rambam writes the following. Right? And we should say in advance that it is very unusual that the Rambam should give you the reason for a mitzvah when it seems gratuitous. Sometimes the Rambam does give a reason. It's a minority of instances. The Rambam will give you the reason. Usually he just lays out the halacha for you. If he gives you a reason, it's usually because it's helpful for you to know the reason for something that has to do with the halacha itself. Here the Rambam chooses to give you the reason. And he tells you, well, what's the reason that you can read them in shul without a minyan? Afal pisha hakol Torah hi Moshe mipi hagvura amaram. Even though it's all Torah and Moshe said it from God's dictation. Nevertheless, ho'ilu mashma'an shehei machar mitat Moshe, since it sounds like when you read it that it's after Moshe, right? That Moshe had already died, right? So hare nishtanu, it's different. Ulefichach, since it's different, mutar liyachid lekrototan. The Rambam takes pains here, at least the by far the most straightforward reading of this Rambam, is that he is taking this language straight from the Gemara's explanation of how Rav's position that you don't need a minyan is consistent even with Rabbi Shimon's position that Moshe wrote the Torah. Now again, from a halachic standpoint, it's very odd that the Rambam would do this because the Rambam is giving you a reason that's actually the harder explanation. It's much easier to understand this halacha if you follow Rabbi Yehuda's position that Yehoshua wrote them. Okay, so they have a different status because Yehoshua wrote them. And the Rambam could have just left out the reason. And yet the Rambam takes pains to tell you, you should know that it's all Torah and Moshe wrote it, right? But as the Gemara says, because they were nishtanu, they were a little different. So therefore, the halacha is different with respect to them also. Why does the Rambam do this very odd thing for the Rambam to do? And the answer, again, the simple answer is just, it seems very, very obvious and straightforward. Even though, again, there are those who read it differently. But the simple answer is that the Rambam, is after all the great, you know, classifier of principles of faith, and the great theologian. And for the Rambam, there are two principles of faith that he presents back to back, the seventh and eighth of his 13 principles of faith. The seventh one is that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is unique. It surpasses the prophecy of anyone else. Moshe Rabbeinu saw prophecy in the clearest way. And as a result, the Torah, this is the eighth principle, the Torah, which was entirely from Moshe, right? That's the eighth principle. That Torah, therefore, cannot be changed. No prophet can come later and alter anything because nobody can match the prophecy of Moshe. That's the simplest way to read the Rambam's juxtaposition of those two principles of faith. For the Rambam, these are strict formal principles that did not admit any easy exceptions or qualification. For the Rambam, it was very important that the whole Torah from beginning to end be Moshe Rabbeinu's unique prophecy. And as such, the Rambam was extremely hesitant and you know, apparently just outright rejected the position of Rabbi Yehuda in the Talmud that Yehoshua wrote those last eight psukim, because it really didn't work with the Rambam's scheme. And so the Rambam does this very distinctive thing in this halacha, which is to give you a reason, which is actually the more difficult reason, because he feels it's necessary to, you know, to make sure you know, in his opinion, that Rav Shimon is correct, and that Moshe wrote those last eight psukim, just as he did, or much as he did, the rest of the Torah. Okay. We should, again, I'm just going to acknowledge the alternative view of Ibn Ezra, who actually kind of in the opposite direction. Ibn Ezra not only says that Yehoshua wrote the last eight psukim beginning with Vayamot Moshe and Moshe died, but Ibn Ezra actually says that for the last 12 psukim, beginning with Vaya'al Moshe, Moshe went up to the mountain. He says, Lefi dati, in my view, Mizeh ha-pasuk katav Yehoshua. Yehoshua really wrote, beginning from the beginning of the passage, which is the beginning of the last perek of the Torah, where it says that Moshe went up the mountain where he was to die. He says, because achar sha'ala Moshe lo yarat. Moshe didn't come down after he went up. So how was he going to transmit the Torah to anybody if he wrote any part of the Torah after he went up, right? That's not going to work. So according to Ibn Ezra, it must be that what the Gemara means is that Yehoshua wrote to the last 12 psukim, beginning from Vayal Moshe, when Moshe goes up the mountain. Ubederech nevuak tavo, right? Gemara Barban, Ibn Ezra makes sure to tell you, you know, Yehoshua wrote it prophetically, just as Moshe wrote the rest of the Torah prophetically. Ibn Ezra is evidently not bothered by the fact that you're going to have a part of the Torah that's Yehoshua's prophecy instead of the unique prophetic capacity of Moshe, which is, after all, something the Torah itself says, that Moshe had a kind of unique prophetic capacity. Ibn Ezra, then the question becomes, does Ibn Ezra expand his view even beyond this? And as I said, this is the big topic, which is not the one we're going to be discussing, but we should acknowledge you have here in the next source. If you're interested in this topic, there's much you can find online about it. But this is a well-known Ibn Ezra at the beginning of our parsha. Now, the first few psukim of our parsha, which tells you, and these are the words that Moshe said, and it's a long introduction, and then it turns it over to Moshe, and Moshe starts speaking. Really, for a couple of reasons, the presentation there strikes people as sounding like it's an introduction written by a later figure. And Ibn Ezra writes on this, Im tavin sod hashnei masar, if you understand the secret of the 12, which might mean those last 12 psukim of the Torah that he's going to tell you about. There's a different ways to understand what that 12 means. He says, if you understand that secret, which the simplest way to read this would mean the secret, right, of psukim that are post Moshe. And he quotes other psukim that sort of sound like they're post Moshe. Kanani az ba'aretz is one. The Kananim were then in the land. Well, when Moshe wrote the Torah, weren't the Kananim still in the land? Right? So, it sounds like, you know, when the person who's writing this is doing so at a time when the Kananim are no longer in the land. So the simplest way to read this Ibn Ezra would be that he's saying, look, there's this secret concerns psukim that were added in later. He says, if you understand that secret, takir ha'amet, you'll know the truth. And then, of course, that opens up a whole big question as to did Ibn Ezra really mean that or not? And there was other evidence that Ibn Ezra resisted the idea that there's material after Moshe. So again, a whole topic which we're going to leave aside, and I want to get to something that will be new for everyone. And it concerns another issue that relates to Sefer Dvarim. In that Sefer Dvarim, we have much material that seems different from what you have elsewhere in the Torah. And the most famously, albeit it's not really the most problematic issue, but the most famously is in the Aseret HaDibrot in Parshat Va'etchanan, which we'll read next week. There is, when Moshe repeats the Aseret HaDibrot to Bnei Yisrael, There is material that is a little different from what you have in the Aseret HaDibrot and Sefer Shmot. And, you know, the obvious, I'm not going to read this inside to save time, but you know, you see the implication of this Ramban, which is the first one, and the assumption simply is that, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu saw fit to say certain things in a way that he thought would be helpful to B'nai Yisrael at this stage. So he explained certain things in a way that are somewhat different from the way God formulated it. There is, of course, the famous Chazal who say that Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad ne'emru. Right? It says in the Aseret HaDibrot and Sefer Shmot that you should remember the Shabbat, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat. In the Aseret HaDibrot, when Moshe repeats it, it's Shamor et Yom HaShabbat, keep the Shabbat. Right? So which one was it? So there is a Chazal that says that they were said in one shot by God, right? That right, a human being can't do this, but they were said in one shot by God. So you do have that source from Chazal, that there's material from Moshe there that really was articulated by God, even if it did not appear in the Aseret HaDibrot in Sefer Shmot. I would like to concentrate for the rest of the time, or almost the rest of the time, on the position of Ibn Ezra. There's a basic position of Ibn Ezra here that is quite well known, but we're going to go a little deeper into it. Ibn Ezra says something here about this disparity between what you find in the Aseret HaDibrot in Shmot and what you find in Dvarim. Ibn Ezra says something that's in keeping with a certain perspective that he has generally in interpreting the Torah. Ibn Ezra is less concerned about slight differences in formulation than other interpreters are. Ibn Ezra regarded there to be just a certain meaning, and the language that's used can be variable. He has certain language he uses for this, and this, you know, when speaking about the Aseret HaDibrot and Sefer Shmot, he's addressing this question. He says, "You should know shehamilot heim kigufot v'hata'amim k'neshamot." He says words are just like bodies; it's the meanings that are the soul, right? And so he says, skipping to the other bolded part, "Or mishpatachav chamim b'chol ashon sheyishmeru hata'amim." He says, in general, he says, no matter what language you're talking about, changing language doesn't matter a whole lot as long as you maintain the meaning. And he says, what's this zachor and shamor disparity? He says, there too, hata'amim shmirot v'lo hamilot. It means the same thing, even though the words are different. I'm going to summarize the rest. What Ibn Ezra tells us, and this is a, he says this is in fact what Chazal mean when they say b'dibur echad, that they were said b'dibur echad, they were said as one by God, is that what they really mean the same thing. That's what it means. And he says, look, right, remember Shabbat means that you're supposed to be aware of the calendar so you'll know to remember when Shabbat is so that you can keep it. And Shamor means keep it. So if you're going to keep it, you have to know the calendar. So he says it all boils down to the same thing, and he's not bothered by that disparity. That's the famous comment of Ibn Ezra. It sounds a little bit radical, but it is his position. He takes this position, he articulates this elsewhere. This is a different work of his. And he tells you with respect to a whole bunch of things. You can glance at these if you like. They include some material from Aseret HaDibrot, a whole bunch of other examples from the Torah, and I'll allude to this again shortly, where, you know, something is repeated and it's repeated in a somewhat different way where the language changes a little bit. And here too, he says, "Hanaviyim einam shomrim hamilot ba'atzmam bishnotam hadavar." When they repeat something, they don't necessarily use the same words. "Rak hata'amim shomrim levadam." They keep the substance, which is the main thing, Shehem HaYikariyim. So the changes in language, he says, don't matter a whole lot. Now, okay, so far, straightforward. That's Ibn Ezra's position. There is another position of Ibn Ezra, which in conjunction with this one has led certain scholars to take a certain, to ascribe a certain radical position to Ibn Ezra. I'm going to argue that it's actually not correct, and that's what we'll do for the next 20 minutes or so. I'll kind of introduce you to this this position among scholars concerning what was Ibn Ezra's view of the way the Torah was written, really the way Moshe prophesied the Torah. After presenting that, I will show you why I think this is actually a mistaken position. There is another Ibn Ezra. Okay? It's in the same other book that Ibn Ezra wrote, a book where he is defending Ibn Ezra. Rav Sadia Gaon from certain critiques of made by the famous grammarian Dunash Ben Labrat. And he says that in this piece, he says that, you know what, I'll just summarize the beginning. He said, Rav Sadia Gaon had said that the language of Yeshayahu was especially sharp and pregnant with meaning. And you know, Dunash was very upset with Rav Sadia Gaon for this, because he says it's all God's word. You open up Sefer Yeshayahu, he says it's God's words. So what are you saying? Yeshayahu had, you know, was sharp in his formulations. What do you mean Yeshayahu? Yeshayahu transmitted God's word. And Ibn Ezra responds that he says Dunash is critiquing Rav Sadia Gaon. He says Dunash is the one who's mistaken. Why? Ki ta'amei hamilot hein keruchot. The meaning of words are like wind, like a spirit, right? Like a neshama, like Ibn Ezra said before, v'dimyonot, right? They're imaginings. Yichad shem Hashem b'nishmat hanavi. Says God places these concepts, these abstractions into the soul of the prophet. V'hu yarkiv ha-ta'amim kifi kocho, in keeping with the prophet's ability, the prophet will then sort of mold them and fashion them into words. Okay? That's Ibn Ezra's position. He says, so don't tell me Yeshayahu didn't write the words of his sefer on his own. Yeshayahu got an abstract prophecy, and he very much did present the words or construct the words on his own. Take this position, and you put it together with what Ibn Ezra says about the Torah. And here is the controversial view that scholars have attributed to Ibn Ezra. They say the following. Ibn Ezra didn't say that all prophets except Moshe prophesied this way. He said that this is the way prophecy works. And so, right, on the surface, we should conclude that Moshe's prophecy works the same way. So when Moshe prophesied what should be in the Torah, he prophesied abstractions. And he, like every other Navi, then proceeds to construct the words and the formulations in keeping with his own ability. And so then, why is Ibn Ezra not as particular about differences in formulation in one part of the Torah and another part of the Torah? He says, well, you know, sometimes Nevi'im will use one formulation, sometimes they'll use another formulation, and it doesn't matter a whole lot, right, if the concept is the same. So this controversial view is that Ibn Ezra allegedly believed that Moshe prophesies the Torah abstractly, constructs the Torah in his own language, and then that accounts for why the precise formulations in the Torah can vary from one passage to the next, right? That's the view. Now, just by way of introduction in critiquing this view, we should note one thing. When Ibn Ezra made his comment about the concepts being like souls and the words being like bodies, and it doesn't matter if you change Zachor to Shamor. And if you look back at that whole paragraph on the bottom of the previous page, every example that Ibn Ezra refers to is an example where a human being is repeating something that someone else said, whether it's God who said it or someone else. So whether it's the Eved of Avraham, right, who's repeating what Rivka said to him and telling the whole story again to Lavan, or whether it's Moshe repeating what God said in the Aseret HaDibrot, and a whole bunch of other, they are all like that. So even, you know, all that Ibn Ezra said explicitly when speaking about the Torah, right, was that when people are repeating words that someone else said, divine or human, people aren't particular, right? So that it's only in quotations. Ibn Ezra never quite used that language about other parts of the Torah. So we don't have any explicit indication that if there are different formulations in general, say in Shemot and Dvarim, or two parts of the Torah that are talking about the same thing, we have no indication from Ibn Ezra explicitly that, oh, that's just because Moshe prophesied the whole thing abstractly and decided to use one formulation in one place and another one in another place because it doesn't matter. Ibn Ezra never said that about the Torah. But I want to emphasize, and you know, this will kind of bring us toward the end, though, is that this conception that Moshe's prophecy is like all other prophets, and Moshe just prophesied things abstractly, and then he decided what words should be in the Torah. Says that view seems to me to run up against some explicit statements in Ibn Ezra. And again, just a brief additional introduction. Even those who take this position and, you know, assign this controversial view to Ibn Ezra acknowledge that there's an exception when it comes to the Aseret HaDibrot, right? With the Aseret HaDibrot, it says explicitly that the words come from God. Okay, so if you'll pardon the pun, but there is clearly a carve-out for the Aseret HaDibrot. Okay, and I'm not seeing your faces, so I hope you're all laughing at the pun. But there's clearly a carve out for the Aseret. It says that God, engraved the Aseret HaDibrot onto the Luchot. So it's not like it's some sort of absolute thing that there can't be a prophecy with words, right? Clearly, there's exceptions. There's at least that one exception to it. Okay, now, so is it just that one exception? Right? Or are there indications that the rest of the Torah was also prophecy with words, so that the words come directly from God? So what does Ibn Ezra have to say about this? So one obvious place to look here is the actual description of Matan Torah itself. I have here in front of you the description of Matan Torah in Sefer Dvarim, in next week's Parsha in Va'et Chana. Well, you recall that B'nai Yisrael find that they can't hear the voice of God. It's too much for them. So they don't want to continue to hear the voice of God. And so in Parshat Va'et Chanan, Moshe sort of tells B'nai Yisrael, you know, you remember what happened then? You told me you couldn't hear the voice of God, and you wanted me to take over instead, and I would just transmit everything from God. Right, because they couldn't hear the voice of God, the kol Elokim Chaim. I'll highlight that term. Right, so there's a kol, there's a voice of God that's coming out during the Aseret HaDibrot. Now you might say, okay, well we know that the Aseret HaDibrot are the big exception, right, where the words come from God according to this view. So maybe what it means, look, B'nai Yisrael hear the first two Dibrot, because there is a position like that very famous view, that B'nai Yisrael heard the first two Dibrot, and then the remainder of the Dibrot, only Moshe heard the voice of God. The thing is that Ibn Ezra does not adopt that view. Ibn Ezra adopts the view that B'nai Yisrael heard all 10 of the Dibrot directly from God. Look at this one here. Ve'et kolo shamanu mitoch ha'esh, we heard God's voice from the esh, aseret ha'dibrot. Ibn Ezra does not adopt the view that it's only those two. He adopts the other view that Bnei Yisrael heard everything. Now think for a minute. If Bnei Yisrael heard everything from God, all aseret ha'dibrot, and then they say, we can't listen to the voice of God anymore. It's too much for us. So Moshe, you continue. Now, the implication would seem to be that there is a voice of God that is communicating additional material, right? And what is that additional material? Moshe says, God responds to Bnei Yisrael's request. He says, look, you Moshe, you stay here with me. Va'adabra elecha et kol ha-mitzvah ba-hukim ba-mishpatim. I will communicate to you all of the mitzvot, all of these laws. And it sounds like there's a lot of material that God is communicating to Moshe at Har Sinai. And if you follow, the sequence here, the Bnei Yisrael couldn't hear all that from God because they couldn't hear God's voice anymore. So the implication would seem to be, at least from Ibn Ezra's position, certainly that Bnei Yisrael heard all the Aseret HaDibrot, the voice that they felt they couldn't continue to listen to was a verbal prophecy that encompassed additional material and encompassed considerable additional material. So this immediately suggests that the voice, the verbal prophecy communicating the content of the Torah extends well beyond the Aseret HaDibrot. And look what Ibn Ezra says. He says, that's what it says. Adabrai lechet kol ha-mitzvah v'chukim ha-mishpatim. God will tell you, Moshe, all of the laws. And v'hine rov ha-Torah v'sinai namar le-Moshe. Most of the Torah, Ibn Ezra says, was communicated to Moshe at Har Sinai. That's right. And then there are other material communicated over the course of the wilderness experience. So it seems very straightforward, at least the most straightforward implication would seem to be, that Ibn Ezra is implying that the lion's share of the Torah is communicated by God with words, with a voice, not as an abstract prophecy that kind of comes into the prophet's mind, right? It sounds like there's actually verbal prophecy for at least the majority of the Torah. One more key source here that really drives home the point. There is a pasuk in Sefer Bamidbar, which after they finish dedicating the Mishkan, and it's time, right, for Moshe to enter the Mishkan, right, and God is going to communicate to him in the Mishkan. And how does God communicate to Moshe? Well, what does the pasuk say? Uvevo Moshe el ohel moed. When Moshe then came into the ohel moed to communicate with God after the Mishkan is dedicated. Vayishma et hakol. Moshe hears the voice midaber elah. The voice is speaking to him, right? And let's skip to the last two words. Vayedaber elah. And God speaks there. Certainly on the surface, just that pasuk alone sounds like Moshe Rabbeinu experienced prophecy, right, in the form of a voice, not just an abstract experience. Now, right, now you might say, all right, others who say, certainly Maimonidean philosophers and others, will often say the conception is really that whatever Moshe sensed was really in a prophet, it wasn't really a voice, whatever it is. What does Ibn Ezra have to say about this? Does Ibn Ezra think this was a real voice? Well, let's take a look at what he says here. First of all, he says, what is this communication that Moshe is getting from God? He says, it could be that what God communicated is really from the Pasuk Vayikra El Moshe at the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. He says, Ibn Ezra says, it seems to him that it's really at the end of this dedication, that's when God communicated Sefer Vayikra to Moshe, right? That's at least one long passage of many chapters long at the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. So whatever we're talking about here, just it's immediately clear that we're talking about a very substantial chunk of material. More important is what Ibn Ezra says next. B'tam v'yishma. What does it mean? Moshe heard this? Shehu haya levado shomea hakol. Moshe heard the voice alone. V'lo yishme'enu misha haya ba'oha mo'ed michutz laparoch. He says no one else who was in the vicinity heard the voice. Why did nobody else hear the voice? Was it because Moshe is really just experiencing an abstract prophecy and it isn't really a voice at all and there's really no words? Is that what? Ki Hashem hosif bahar gashat oznav, right? God enabled Moshe to hear better than other people, right? Moshe's ears became more sensitive, just as he does in other cases with certain other prophets. Right? Ibn Ezra is very, very clear that Moshe is hearing something, right? He is hearing God's voice. And lest you think this is just, okay, this is another chunk of material here that's an exception, but that usually Moshe's experiencing prophecies abstractly, and that's really the way the Torah was written. Look at the very last part of this Ibn Ezra. Vayedaber elav, you got this extra phrase at the end where it repeats that God spoke to him. What does that extra phrase indicate? Ibn Ezra says it indicates that kach haya mishpat hadibur tamid. Every time Moshe communicates with God in the Mishkan, this is the method. Okay, now we take a step back here and evaluate the claim that was made that the Torah must be Moshe Rabbeinu's own words according to Ibn Ezra, because Ibn Ezra told us that Nevi'im experience their prophecies abstractly, and it's they who write the words, and he doesn't say there's an exception for Moshe. Well, I think it's very clear when you look at these sources that we've seen that there is an understood exception pertaining to Moshe, and it's not just an exception that's limited to the Aseret HaDibrot. It's very clear from both of these passages in the Ibn Ezra, especially the second one, which is really the more important one, that tells you how Moshe communicated with God on a regular basis. Very clear that Ibn Ezra perceived, in keeping with the traditional view, the common traditional view, which is that Moshe did experience verbal prophecies from God, which makes it really entirely unnecessary and really unsubstantiated to claim that Ibn Ezra regarded the Torah, which traditionally is said to have been communicated by God in all of its words and formulations. There's really no reason to argue or any justification for claiming that Ibn Ezra thinks otherwise. Rather, his claim that prophecies are abstract seems to be limited to other Nevi'im. So we have 2 minutes. I'll just finish on something entirely different about the nature of the way Sefer Dvarim is written. It will end with a little Dvar Torah here. There's most of Sefer Dvarim is about listening to God's mitzvot. And, you have the curses and blessings and, the admonishments. It's really about heeding God's, mitzvot. If you don't listen to the mitzvot, if you do listen to the mitzvot, you have this formulation in Parshat Re'eh Anochi Noten Lifneichem Hayom Bracha Uklala. There's a blessing and a curse. What's the blessing and the curse? Ata Bracha Asher Tishmu El Mitzvot Hashem Elokeichem. The bracha is if you listen to God's mitzvot, and haklalaim lo tishmu el mitzvot Hashem Elokeichem. Right, the first half of the sefer is really about listening to mitzvot. There's a very different flavor that kicks in at the end when you kind of get to Parshat Nitzavim and Vayelech. It's a much, much more general less detailed, less specific mandate of sort of listen to what God said here and God said there. There's a much, much more general kind of way it gets formulated. And I'll just call your attention to this Re'eh. There's another Re'eh here where God says another re'ei natati lefnechem, I am placing before you. Doesn't say how mitzvah, the mitzvah, the bracha and klala vis-a-vis mitzvot, and you know, whether you follow the mitzvot or not, but rather it says, I'm placing before you et ha-chayim ve-et ha-tov, ve-et ha-mavet ve-et ha-ra, I'm placing before you life and good, as opposed to death and evil. And he says, and I'm telling you, right, ha-chayim ve-ha-mavet natati lefanecha ha-bracha ve-ha-kvala, since I placed before you life and death, blessing and curse, uvacharta b'chayim, right? You have a responsibility to choose life. It's sort of a much, much more general kind of choice. This is really the source that's always cited for, you know, free will from the Torah. And it's interesting that when it talks about free will here, it's talking in the context not of specific mitzvot and aveirot, but in terms of what choices a person makes much more broadly, in a much more overarching way. Because, and this is the way, you know, the way many people look at the realities of the choices we make, is that for the most part, the choices we make are not chiefly in the context of, am I going to do this correctly, or am I going to heed this mitzvah or not? Most of those choices are effectively made at times when we decide what kind of people we want to be, and at moments of reflection, of cheshbon ha-nefesh, of deciding whether we're going to kind of choose a better path or not. And the mitzvot and aveirot really flow from that. So with that perspective on the choices that we make, this time of year in conjunction with a very, very difficult time for Klal Yisrael, is in addition to everything else, or in conjunction with everything else, naturally a time of reflection and cheshbon hanefesh in advance of Tisha B'Av and with Elul approaching. So my bracha to all of you is that you and me and all of us should merit making all the right choices. Uvacharta b'chayim, we get to choose life, and we'll get, along with the rest of Klal Yisrael, to experience life, and God forbid, not the opposite. And with that, we should merit a geulah shleima b'mehra b'yameinu. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions? You can unshare your screen if you'd like.
Yeah, I have to figure that out.
One or two little comments. I think you basically touched upon the comments in the as you spoke. I don't know if anybody has any questions. Speak up or forever hold your breath.
I thank you so much. I learned so much. I do have one point where I think that Tamim means trough. Ibn Ezra puts great, great stock in the trough. The trough is the tone, is the music, and that's what he is saying, how a regular Navi, especially, not so much Moshe, but a regular Navi, because he's getting the Navua not in a real Dibuk, Hashem Yidaber Ish El Reyehu, with a call. So he sort of parses the words afterwards, and that's what the Trop does. He says Shamar Es Yom. Shamar Es Yom is one phrase in the Trop. And I didn't study it in depth. You know, you flashed it on the screen, but I believe that's what he means. Shamar Es Yom is one phrase, and that's kolel much more than zachor, which stands on its own. Shamar es yom, in Yisro, in Yitro, it's zachor es yom hashabbat. So shamar et yom is kolel much more. I believe that's what he's trying to convey.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I think the phrase, you know, his big phrase here is hamilim heim kegufot v'hatamim kenashamot.
Exactly.
You know, the way, exactly. You know, if you're right, then it's real. Then your position would really revolutionize the way this Ibn Ezra is typically understood, because, you know, the idea is, as far as I know, universally understood to be that it's, you know, the words versus what they mean. You know, ta'am in, you know, in medieval parshanim, you know, is one of the meanings of the word ta'am. It's something that you know, we have to kind of be taught because it's not instinctive, because in school we're taught that ta'am means a reason, right? But, you know, ta'am means a meaning. So that's the way, it's the best of my knowledge, that's the way it's universally understood. I'm not sure, you know, how your reading could quite be worked through, but again, if you're right, it would be revolutionary. Yeah, that's all I'll say. So, but by all means, you know, look, work through it carefully. And if you think that it's defensible, and then by all means, pays to pursue it.
My other comment was about which you actually refer to in the content. It's on Vachanani Oz Baretz, as of course you know, but just to explain the comment, and in Parshat Lech Lecha, on the words that you explained to us, the Sofnat Panech, who wrote his Sefer at the behest of his best friend, who was the Rambam's descendant, Rabbeinu David, who was the Parnas in Damascus. So he wrote his work, you know, you can think of it as Descartes writing his work, Lahavdil, you know, about rationalism, Alpi, his Catholic bishop. Here, Yosef Tov Elam, who's not the Baal Tosfot, and this is a third Yosef Tov Elam, he wrote his Sefer at the behest of Rabbeinu David, who is the Rambam's, I think, great-great-great-grandson. Defender, of course, of the legacy. And he says that the Nevi'im Rishonim added some explanatory, nothing to do about mitzvot. The Rambam's dictum is about mitzvot. They are immutable. However, Hakanani Oz Baaretz and, you know, other things were added by Nevi'im Rishonim, and Yoshua Sukkim are one of the rayot to this.
Yeah, I mean, that's Sofnat Panech is, you know, that's the major source who interprets Ibn Ezra straightforwardly and expands on it. I don't want to spend more time on it, just because, you know, it was something I chose not to dwell on. So with that topic, we would, you know, we could go on forever.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Yitzchak, and all the best. Okay. Next week, Aviyat Tabori from Camp Stone. He's from Israel, but he's in Camp Stone. We'll be giving the shiur. Tomorrow morning, of course, my shiur on the Siddur, regular time, 9:15, Slach Lenu Avinu. And, next week, Rabbi Liebtag and Benny Gesundheit on Sunday morning. And then Tuesday, of course, our 11 to 7 Eastern, 8 speakers, 1 hour each, for Tisha B'Av, I assume. I hope most of you have registered already, and, at least come for part of the day, all the day. And, we should be zocha for Tisha B'Av to become a holiday, like you were sort of alluding to the end. And, everybody, okay, hope to see you soon. Invite your friends, let people know, and Shabbat Shalom, and be well, everybody. Laila Tov. Shabbat.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.